Radio Real. Real radio, your reality.
Welcome to Off the Shelf,
the Second Life radio show and podcast about books and the people who love them.
I'm Kegia Girardi.
And this is Simeon Beresford.
Join us as we survey the literary scene in our virtual world. Hello, and welcome to the second season of Off the Shelf.
Yes, welcome. This is the first time we've been on Radio Real's mainstream, so fingers crossed that we manage that handover well. And welcome to our new listeners. We're very pleased to have New York Times bestselling author Vicki Peterson as our guest today. Kegia is a bit of a fan, so I will let her introduce Vicki.
I am a fan. I discovered Vicki's books last summer, and I'm thrilled to have the opportunity to talk with her about her work. Vicki has published 4 dark urban fantasy novels so far, and the next one is due out in June. Welcome to Off the Shelf, Vicki.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Let's start by providing a little background for our listeners. Who is Joanna Archer, and what are the signs of the zodiac to her?
Sure. Well, Joanna Archer, in short, is a modern-day superhero. Essentially, she's the Signs of the Zodiac series follows Joanna, and she's a woman who's caught in the crossfire between, you know, battling factions of shadow and light, representative of good and evil in our world. And she finds herself in a, you know, previously unrealized paranormal underworld. So we're following her journey as she kind of muddles her way through that that world. And lest that sound too gloomy, I set the story in my, you know, bright, bold hometown of Las Vegas.
I love the fact that you call her a superhero rather than a witch or paranormal. You know, that definitely gives you a context for who Joanna is.
Well, I mean, it's obviously a huge part of her new makeup, and she's not a witch. I mean, she's none of those things, and I was the paranormal aspect of the series, you know, kind of popped up and came out of nowhere for me. So when I was discovering that aspect of her, you know, I was trying to figure out, well, who do I want to read about? And superhero and superhero fiction was all over in popular media, but I didn't see a lot of it in prose. Hardly any at all. So it just interested me, and it was a chance to go ahead and play with some of those the comic book form, you know, in the novel form. So that's been really fun for me. I'm glad you find it interesting.
So I gather that Joanna is a blend of light and shadow sides. Does this create any special problems for her?
Oh yes, you know, it's the biggest problem for her, but it's also her biggest asset. She is definitely a blend of light and shadow, straight down the middle. Without giving too much away, I think I can tell you that her father is shadow, leader of the shadow side, and her mother is light. And so this is, you know, very conflicting, you know, for anybody to try and figure out who they are when you know, their parents are one of each or one of the other. So she's most definitely a blend of the two, and you know, there are times, I will confess, when some of her more, you know, darker impulses come out and kind of come to the foreground. But that's fun for me to play with. I don't like characters who are black and white, you know, very shiny, or, you know, wearing the black hat all of the time. So I like the ambiguity there.
Okay, so how do her companions feel about this? I mean, doesn't it make her very unpredictable?
Well, you know, and that creates a big story arc through the entire series, you know, how people interact with her and deal with somebody essentially that they haven't seen before, you know, with the shadow side. You know, they obviously would like her to come and play in their sandbox. The light isn't too sure of her because of her, you know, more, if she can even be trusted because of her more shadowy impulses, you know, and she's, you know, this is, the entire game is new to her, at least in the sense of shadows. So she doesn't even know, you know, if she can be trusted, you know, what is this? Who am I? And so those are questions that I continue to explore, you know, throughout the series. You know, people tend to wear masks, and I thought it was a wonderful way to approach that you know, and you know, pull the mask off layer by layer and see who, exactly the person, you know, who the person is underneath.
That's all superhero fiction is about, masks, when you get down to it, isn't it?
Well, life is about it when you get down to it, you know, so...
Second life is definitely about it.
Yeah, the first life or the second life, that's right.
Las Vegas is, you mentioned earlier, is more than just the setting for your books, though. It seems like the city's really closely tied to the action, and it's not just the casino part of the of Vegas that we're seeing. I really love the old graveyard for the casino signs. Yeah. Does that exist in Vegas?
Absolutely. Absolutely it does. And thank you for mentioning that. I actually see Las Vegas as another character, another key character in the story. And unlike, you know, superheroes in prose, I had read, you know, fiction, obviously, that was set in Las Vegas before, and most of it got it wrong. I mean, that stuff that, you know, locals would... read or look at and go, come on, that could never happen. Those streets don't even intersect, you know, something that you could, you know, find on Google Maps. But more than anything, I wanted to get like a local flavor out there of the city, that it is so much more than, you know, just the bright and shiny of one street, you know. And it's not, you know, the fiction that I was reading set in Las Vegas, with the exception, very few exceptions, maybe Michael Connelly's Void Moon captured it. But there's not a whole lot that actually goes beyond, you know, the surface. So I kind of wanted to show, you know, the Las Vegas that I grew up with.
I think that's very apparent, and I appreciate it, because it, you know, with CSI being set there, that tends to be what everybody thinks of Vegas now as much as the casinos.
That's right. That's right.
Oh, yes. We all know what TV series are like. They always run down one street and come out at another street on the other side of town. And you think, how did they get from there to there?
Truly. You know, I'll tell you a problem that I've been having is, can I really have a running down another dark alley? I'm like, how many dark alleys are there in Vegas? You know, it's a city of neon. So that's been interesting in the later books. Just trying to keep her out of the urine-drenched alleys. Because it was cute the first time, but not so much after that.
Yeah, there's a grittiness with some of your characters, definitely.
A little bit, yeah. But, you know, the boneyard is absolutely real. And that is, you know, I'll admit I had an agenda there, and I wanted other people to know about it. It's the neon boneyard. It's, you know, downtown. And here's the problem now is they took the Silver Slipper. It's now on a big, you know, ginormous stripper pole downtown because they refurbished it and they, you know, changed out all the bulbs and made it beautiful and shiny again. So it's no longer in the Boneyard. And for, you know, anybody who's read the series, you'll know that that's how, you know, my superheroes get to their sanctuary. So this solves a problem because now they have to climb a big stripper pole in order to get into the... Silver Slipper, yes, I got to figure that out now. Aladdin's lamp, the original Aladdin's lamp, is still in the Boneyard, so I might have to move him there.
so you keep it contemporary that way.
Yeah, well, or dated, you know. Oh, well, this is obviously written before the slipper got thrown on the pole. Oh, well, what are you going to do?
But you can see them going down the stripper pole like a fireman's pole, you know. It's getting in that's going to be the problem.
In some of those outfits, I'm not sure that would work. Have you seen what Joanna wears?
Well, at least it's not cold. It's Vegas.
Yeah, yeah. Well, for the most part, you're right. It's not.
Okay. Well, the other thing that I really found intriguing about your books was the use of comic books, and especially the comic book store as part of the storyline. And it's become... It stays important throughout the series so far that I've read. let me figure out how to ask this question now that I've led into it so well. What inspired the comic book store as a major setting in your book?
Well, some people say that the books are a little dark and a little gritty. And honestly, I needed some lighter moments and I needed some happy. And as long as I'm playing with superhero, you know, mythology, how can I not go into a comic book shop? And to be honest, they're a little mysterious to me. I didn't grow up reading comic books all the time. I was always into long prose. So the first time I went into a comic book shop, I kind of did so opening the door slowly, peeking my head in, see if someone was going to throw something at me, and or if I needed a password or something like that. But I really approached it the same way Joanna did, like, what is going on in here? And turns out there's a lot more going on than either her or I ever knew. I mean, I have found the most marvelous stories and storytelling, and I'm, I have a kid, and I'm now, beginning to think about what stories in graphic form I'm going to be introducing, to my child. But I really needed a bit of happy in the books, and these people are so much fun to hang out with. And then as the series developed, it turns out they have a far, far more intricate, they're more important to the world than even I knew, because I don't plot out, my series or my books, in advance. I kind of let it grow organically from the characters and the situation and, interweave it all together. So it was actually surprising when I found out, how important all of them were.
So you're an active comic book reader yourself.
I have become more active, yeah. In fact, I was at comic book shop just yesterday, poring over everything. I'll read Bill Willingham's Fables is a huge favorite of mine still. I mean, I think they're really accessible. And then IDW publishes Joe Hill, this series, Lock and Key, which is so dark and so gritty. It absolutely is fascinating and kind of scares me. So it's been very interesting because seeing something in my mind transferred to the page in prose is one thing, but seeing the graphic art that accompanies it, it's a totally different reading experience. Like, it evokes different emotions in me than it would otherwise if it were just prose. So it's fun. It's absolutely fun. I wish I'd found it sooner.
Well, you seem to have nailed what I would call the stereotypes of the people that kind of live in the comic book stores.
Yes.
Have you noticed that as well?
Well, I did it. That was purposeful. Like, Joanna's approaching it as a neophyte. And so I wanted to start out with those, but then dig deeper. It's the same thing with the superheroes. Okay, they have a weapon and they have, something on their chest. But what is the meaning behind that? Why? There has to be something deeper, and it's all, is linked to the world building. So and that's why these people are so important to the Zodiac world, because there is something deeper. They're not just geeks.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad to hear it.
It's definitely one of those things that I emphasize when I tell other people about your books.
Oh yeah, no, it's actually one of the biggest reader feedback that I get is on the comic book shop scenes, and so I try to have them in almost every novel. The story comes first, so I let the story lead it, but when they're not on the page, I really, really miss them. I agree with my readers. I love it there. It actually feels like a real shop to me. I love it.
Well, it's time for the musical interlude now, but before that, we're going to play a little promo from Emerian Rich M's.
HorrorAddicts.net, a place for horror writers, artists, musicians, gamers, and enthusiasts.
Come here.
No! No! No!
We're going to get them.
Hosted by writer Emerian Rich, with music by The Speaker Freaks. HorrorAddicts.net. A website, a podcast, a lifestyle.
We'll be right back.
too long since my last fix.
Well, that was How Long Blues by Davis Cohen with Eric Von Schmidt from Mevio Music Alley. Check it out at music.mevio.com. Okay, Vicki, you're back on the hot seat.
Oh, great.
Let's talk a little bit about Joanna's universe, not that we haven't been already.
Okay.
It's obvious that the Zodiac carries a lot of its own mythology. How did you reinvent it for the series and make it fit in a modern world?
Well, it actually started with Joanna herself. I mean, my stories always grow out of the character in asking questions about the characters before I even really ask questions about the world or the universe. So, you know, the scene that spawned my interest in Joanna actually, I hate to say this, it sounds so precious. It actually came to me in a dream, fully formed. Here's this girl full of attitude, and it was fun. It was dangerous. And if you remember in Scent of Shadows, there's a girl standing there with a stiletto, not the knife, but the shoe, trying to fend off this big, you know, enormous man in leather. And I was like, you know, who is this woman? Why is this man trying to kill her? And, you know, what exactly is the situation here? Well, that didn't actually turn out to be Joanna, but that got me started. It's very strange the way, you know, creativity works. One thing just leads to the next. It's just a matter of asking yourself questions or even the right questions. So, and then I combined a few other elements that have taken hold of my imagination, such as the superheroes, and ended up unwittingly writing urban fantasy. I had no idea what it was I was writing. I was just having so much fun doing it. I kept combining all of these elements like Las Vegas and the superheroes and this tough girl in leather and just trying to figure out how it all fit together. So and the supernatural aspects, as I said before, was the most surprising, you know, part of it. the realization that these people were contemporary superheroes and villains, and that just mushroomed up out of nowhere. There's a character in the third chapter of that book who pops up and says he's a superhero. And instead of going, no, he's not, I'm writing a thriller or a mystery or whatever, I said, well, what if he is? And so just playing along with that turned the whole series on its head.
Wow. So you mentioned earlier that it does flow organically. How much of it do you plot out and how much of it do you keep track of so that you don't mess up your own storylines in your later books?
Yeah, well, more and more in the later books, I have to plot just to remember everything that I've had going on in the previous four books. So that's become a necessity. But even if I plot out the entire book, I will go about 100 pages in and then have to replot it. And then maybe I'll do another 50 or 100 pages and I'll have to replot the rest of that because the characters just take off. I don't want to say they do their own thing and I'm completely out of control because that makes me sound like a crazy person, but they kind of take off and do their own thing if you're doing it right. If they're fully realized people to you, there become things and actions and things they say and do that they can't do anything but that. And so, like I said, character comes first. So I just kind of write around them.
Yeah. That leads me into my next question. Uh-huh. Your major characters are mirrored in the comic books. So how do you keep the characters remaining three-dimensional? And do you have a conflict between that comic book character and the real life, for lack of a better term, character?
Well, I guess the easy answer, and unfortunately short answer, is that it's easy because now they're people to me. They're real people. They're not characters. Warren has a set of mores and values he absolutely will not change, no matter what, no matter who you are, no matter what you say. And so he's going to act in a certain way no matter what. So I know exactly, I know them all so very well now that there's not that sort of conflict there. That would be like, telling you to change your favorite color or your favorite drink. Just change it, and you can't because that's part of, what makes you who you are. So I can't do that with them either at this point.
Great. Did your writing change much when you shifted from being a showgirl who wrote on the side to being a full-time writer with a book deal?
I wouldn't say that the writing changed, maybe my approach to it. I definitely had to find things, try to expedite it. Now you're writing on a deadline, you have a schedule, your publisher has a schedule, and basically I guess I treated it more professionally. Now that I had a contract, I had to write like I had the contract, whereas before it was definitely playing around and no real deadline. A personal deadline, but those are so arbitrary, Sometimes I have personal deadlines. I'm going to write a book this month, and that's silly. It's not going to happen. So, so that's what changed. I really started treating it like a career, as you must. But Kim Harrison gives some really great advice, which is you must, for aspiring writers, is treat writing like you already have the contract. Write like you already have the contract. And I think that's wonderful advice because once you do have it, it's almost too late to start. I mean, you got to start acting like a professional prior to that. So I would agree with that.
She's another great author.
She's fantastic.
Yeah, favorite of mine.
Okay.
So in addition to the Zodiac series, it says here you've written for some short story anthologies.
Mm-hmm.
With Kim Harrison, amongst others, oddly enough.
Yeah.
Did you find the shorts very different to write?
Yes, I hadn't written any shorts prior to the Holidays Are Hell anthology. That was the first one I did. And I was definitely a little worried at first because my first drafts sprawl. They just tend to sprawl. I'll cut them down by 20,000-30,000 words and they'll still be too long. So, and I've actually gotten better at that as with each book. So, that's I'm learning. But I didn't know if I could write a whole story in 25,000 words or 10,000 words or 7,000 words. So I did it. You have to include the entire story arc, and you have a much shorter frame to do it. And I actually find I like it. And boy, the immediate gratification is fantastic. You know, you don't have to wait a whole year, you know, for the idea to develop and then finally come out. It develops a lot more quickly, so that's fun.
If it goes wrong, you know in time.
You know very quickly. Yes, you do. You do.
Yeah, it's not like 6 months later you go, oh, what? How did I get here?
There's no worse feeling.
Your next book is coming out in June, Cheat the Grave. Can you tell us anything about it that's going to make us get even more impatient for it?
Yes, but then I'd have to kill you. No, if you've read the fourth book, you'll know there are some unresolved personal issues between Joe and a number of characters. Warren is one. That was her, is troop leader. And, of course, Hunter is a very big one as well. And so those will be addressed. But the biggest unresolved issue is one that's pretty much been there, you know, going on from the first. And that's with Joanna and her mother, Zoe Archer. So that might be a little bit of a hook there, drag you along.
It comes to the fore.
Great.
All right, Vicki, we have a final question for you. Sure. What are you reading at the moment?
Oh, gosh. I don't read one book at a time. I'm so structured with my work and in everything else that I do that reading is an absolute, it's like grabbing popcorn and shoving a big handful in my mouth. I can't be structured about it. So I'm reading about four books right now. I'm reading Megan Abbott, Queenpin, which is like a throwback to the 40s, 50s detective novels, you know, those gold medal novels.
We were just talking about her earlier today.
Oh, you've got to get her in here. She is so marvelous. She's such a wonderful stylist. I can't say enough good things about her. And then nonfiction, I'm going to go pick up Elizabeth Gilbert's Committed today because that just came out. And so I was very late to the Eat, Pray, Love bandwagon because anything that's really popular, I refuse to read. But then I thought, well, it must be popular for a reason. So I went out and bought it and was very happy that I did. So I'm reading that. I'm reading Mike Carey. I just recently found him. I don't know where he's been hiding in the comic book world, I guess, but The Devil You Know. And so I'm going to read his entire Felix Castor series. And then I love crime fiction, so I'm reading Teresa Schwagel. Her entire backlist. I've read two of her books, and she's this. She writes police procedural set in Chicago, and she is phenomenal. And I'm shocked at how many people don't know her name, Teresa Schwagel. She's fast. So I love my prose.
We will definitely include a list of those authors that Vicki mentioned on our show notes. All right.
Castor's on my list as someone I have to read as well.
Who's that? Who's that?
Casper.
Mike Carey's. Yeah.
Yes, Mike Carey's.
Yes. Okay. So good.
Well, we have run out of time, if you can believe it. And after we finish the podcast, we're going to let our audience ask some questions in world off the podcast. So thank you for coming, and listen, you can find out more at www.thebookstacks.org/off-the-shelf.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Off the Shelf is produced for Radio Real by Kegia Girardi and Simeon Beresford. Technical production is by Radio Real. You can find Radio Real on the web at radioreal.org. Music on this program includes works by artists on the Magnatune label. The music in the general introduction is John Playford's All in a Garden Green by Eileen Hadidian and Natalie Cox from their album Dolce Musica, A Contemplative Journey. The off-the-shelf theme music is 1500 Tons by Burning Babylon from the album Stereo Mashup. And we bid you goodbye with this piece, Hagagasan 14 by Eternal Jazz Project from their album Gratis Jazz. You can learn more about Magnatune and their artists on their website at magnatune.com. Off the Shelf is licensed under Creative Commons.